Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, avid KUOW listeners know journalist Maria Hinojosa as the longtime host of the NPR program Latino USA. It airs on Tuesday nights at 11. She is also the founder and CEO of the Futuro Media Group, which produces the program. Hinojosa and her team have been reporting on how Latinos and Hispanics experience and impact the United States since 1992. That ethnic group accounted for more than half of the total U.S. population growth from 2000 to 2014. The Pew Research Center predicts they will make up 24% of the population here by 2065. In addition to her prolific work as a journalist and media leader, Hinojosa is also the author of two books, Raising Raul, Adventures Raising Myself and My Son, and Cruz, Gang Members Talk to Maria Hinojosa. She gave this talk, Testing the Limits of Due Process Denial, Latinos and Immigrants as the Canaries in the Mine, at the University of Washington's Kane Hall, on November 1st, 2017. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum. Here, Yvette Moy, UW's Director of Public Lectures, introduces the program.
The Graduate School six-part series on equity and difference will focus on rights. Who has them, who doesn't, who needs them, and why it's important to fight for them. And we're here tonight because of a generous gift to the University of Washington. The Marianne and John D. Mangles Endowed Lecture Series was established in 1990 to honor the retirement of John D. Mangles, former chairman and CEO at Security Pacific Bank of Washington, which is now Bank of America. Administered by the Graduate Opportunities and Minority Achievement Program, or GOMAP, the Mangles Lectureship, in cooperation with academic departments and programs, brings to the University of Washington campus minority scholars or individuals whose work focuses on issues of diversity from a variety of fields for the benefit of minority students, the campus community, and the general public. Taking the lead on recruitment and retention of minority graduate students, GOMAP is nationally recognized for its unique and innovative efforts in mentoring, networking, and professional development of our students. Through experiences rich in cultural diversity, GOMAP fosters an inclusive graduate community in which all students can learn and develop the skills to participate in academic, civic, and professional endeavors. Congratulations for all the work that you do, GOMAP. You make our campus community stronger and more inclusive. Tonight's speaker, Maria Hinojosa, will be introduced by Associate Dean of Diversity and Student Affairs, Gino Eisenberg.
Good evening. Buenas noches. Thank you for joining us. As Yvette stated, I'm Gino Eisenberg, and I'm very pleased to be with you here tonight to introduce tonight's speaker, Maria Hinojosa. Her presence among us here at the University of Washington is really the fruit of multiple departments across the university, who nominated her to be one of the public lecturers, and we're very grateful. For 25 years, Maria Hinojosa has helped tell America's untold stories and brought to light unsung heroes in America and abroad. In April of 2010, Maria Hinojosa launched the Futuro Media Group with a mission to produce multi-platform, community-based journalism that gives critical voice to the voiceless by harnessing the power of independent media to tell stories that are overlooked or ignored by traditional media. As the anchor and executive producer of the long-running weekly NPR show Latino USA, and as anchor of the Emmy Award-winning talk show, Maria Hinojosa, One-on-One, Maria has informed millions of Americans about the fastest growing population in our country, Latinos. Previously, a senior correspondent for Now on PBS, and currently, a rotating anchor for Need to Know, Maria Hinojosa has reported hundreds of important stories, from immigrant work camps in New Orleans after Katrina, to teen girl adolescents victims of sexual harassment on the job, to Emmy Award-winning stories of the poor in Alabama. Maria Hinojosa has won top honors in American journalism throughout her career. In 2009, she was honored with an AWRT Gracie Award for Individual Achievement as Best TV Correspondent. In 2010, she was awarded an honorary degree, Doctor of Humane Letters by DePaul University in Chicago, as well as the Sidney Hillman Prize honoring her social and economic justice reporting. In 2012, she additionally received an honorary degree from Simmons College, named among the 25 Latinos in contemporary American culture by the Huffington Post, and gave the prestigious Ware Lecture. In 2013, Maria Hinojosa taught at DePaul University as the Sor Juana Inez de la Cruz Chair of the Latin American and Latino Studies Program. Throughout her career, Maria Hinojosa has helped define the conversation about our times and our society with one of the most authentic voices in broadcast. I come open to listen to Maria tonight, but also to be challenged. I come very respectful, not just to listen, not just to be inspired, but also to act. Maria was born in Mexico City, raised in Chicago, and received her BA from Barnard College. Please join me in welcoming Maria Hinojosa.
Thank you. Well, hello, Seattle. Yes. Gee, I don't even want to think about what time it is for me, considering that I just flew in from the East Coast. Not like I'd be in bed at this hour usually. No. Anyway, thank you to the university and to everybody involved. I was hearing that there were lots and lots of people involved. That always, I'm like, really? There were a lot of people who wanted me to come here? Okay. I take every invitation as a kind of special joy, so I really appreciate that. I bet the lighting people are not happy now because I'm all the way on the side, though. All right. Okay. So, and I was going to do a little bit of walking around, but I think because of the microphone, I won't be able to, so you're stuck with seeing me here. I'll try to make it as entertaining as possible. As you know, I'm a journalist. I'm also a storyteller. So I tell stories, and I'm going to start by telling you a story that just happened. I was at home this past Saturday morning. I was meditating. I was actually on my bed meditating in the morning when I got a phone call on my phone that has the app where I meditate. So it's kind of obvious, but I usually would have not even cared. I would have not taken the call, but something told me to take the call. It was a call from California, and on the other end of the line, somebody said, "Hello, is this Maria? My name is Susan Burton." And I said, "Yes, and who are you?" And she said, "I'm Ms. Burton." And I said, "Wait a second, you mean from the book, Becoming Ms. Burton?" And she said, "Yes, that's me." And I don't know if any of you have read the book, but it's kind of a really important book in the conversation around criminal justice reform. Becoming Ms. Burton, the author, Ms. Burton, was, thank you. Susan Burton served about 20 years in prison. She had a very normal life. But when her little boy was 5 years old, she saw him die in front of her, and it took her through a tumble, and she started using drugs and then selling drugs. And she ended up writing a book, because since she's come out, she's dedicated her life to helping women and men in reentry. So she said to me on the phone, "I met your brother. I'm so happy he's coming out of prison." And I said, "That's great. He's not really my brother." Just to kind of clarify, because I bet you guys were like, "What?" But the person that she was talking about, his name is Suave. And Suave has been in prison for 30 years, and I think it's 8 months at this point. And he's not my brother, even though he does call me his sister. I've met Suave in 1993, when I was asked to go to the prison where he was. It's the fifth largest state prison in the country. It's Graterford State Prison in Pennsylvania. And I had been asked to go and give a commencement speech for prisoners who were graduating from either a high school, a GED, a college, or a tailoring, or learning how to cut hair. So I was giving the commencement speech. And in that speech, I talked about how I didn't see a separation between myself and the people who I was addressing. In this case, they were all citizens convicted of crimes and serving sentences. And because of my work and family and friends, I've actually, at that time, this was 1993, had actually been in and out of several prisons. So I approached prisons not with the kind of mysterious of like, "Oh my God," but rather something that happens. And so when I gave this commencement speech, Suave, who was in the audience, and by that time he had been serving maybe 8 years, and Suave was sentenced to life in prison when he was 17 years old. So when I met Suave, and there were a group of prisoners who came to see me, came up to me after I gave the commencement speech, and Suave was one of them. There were several, but Suave was one of them who came up to me, and he spoke, and he told me that he had been sentenced to life in prison when he was 17 years old, and that he was a lifer. He wasn't going to get out, and that he hated the prison. And he said, "You know, but I was," he said, "I felt very inspired by your speech. It's very few people who come here and speak to us like they see us." And he said, "What should I do? I'm going to be here for the rest of my life. What should I do?" And I said to Suave something that I've said to many, many times, and which I've kind of devoted my career to as a journalist. I said, "Well, you know what, Suave, you're on the inside." I said, "I will never be able to see what you're going to see from the inside of this prison. You need to be the eyes and ears. You need to be the voice for the voiceless. You need to tell these stories." And then Suave wrote to me, and then I went back to the prison and I interviewed him again as part of another story. And we developed I don't call it a relationship because I can never call Suave, so it's an experience of two human beings who have contact. I didn't know that saying those words to Suave, "Look, you can be the voice for the voiceless, keep your eyes open, let me know, tell me the stories that I need to know about this prison." I didn't know that encounter was gonna change Suave's life. When Suave was sentenced to life in prison as a 17-year-old, he was illiterate. That's why he didn't take the plea deal that had been offered to him, because he didn't even know what a plea deal was, and he knew that he hadn't committed the crime, he hadn't pulled the trigger, even though he was in the presence of the murder. So he didn't take the plea. And he ended up in solitary for being something of a rebel. And it was in solitary that another prisoner taught him how to read through the cells, starting off with words like cat, dog, mom. Suave learns how to read. Suave then ends up getting his GED. And then Suave takes 16 years to get his BA. And as he likes to say, the best 16 years of my life to get my bachelor's, 16 years. He's now in a master's program. He created a scholarship inside the prison where he would collect money from the prisoners to create a scholarship fund for a young person on the outside. I know, it's like, what? Especially because if you know that if you're inside and you work, you get paid maybe 50 cents an hour. So to donate even a dollar is 2 hours of work. Suave creates a program called Fathers and Children Together, FACT, even though he has no children. He creates a Latino educational program inside. And Suave was not coming out. Suave was sentenced to life in prison. But you know, our country has had a fascinating history around criminal justice, complicated, controversial, intense. And as I was writing this, I was thinking, how can I make, you know, something make it feel more real to you in the sense of how criminal justice and laws around criminal justice have changed and impacted us. You know, when I was growing up about a billion years ago, it was a really long time ago. Domestic violence, intimate partner violence, was not necessarily considered a crime. It was something that happened behind closed doors that police didn't get involved with. Even rape, sexual harassment, sexual assault, no. Those things were fought by activists, by human beings, by individuals, sometimes just one individual, to create laws to protect us. As you know, it was illegal to get an abortion. It was illegal. There was no context even to sue for racial discrimination. All of those things are things that were fought for by individuals, people just like you. So now we all know what it is to get Mirandized. Although all of us are watching in real time what it looks like to be denied to be read your Miranda rights. Now all of you, if you don't know the Miranda rights, you've all watched Law and Order, you know when the person is arrested and they say, you know, anything you say can and will be used against you in the court of law. If you can't afford an attorney, you're being arrested for this reason. We all know this, right? We take it for granted. That did not exist if it were not for Miranda and the laws that push for us to create the possibility to be Mirandized. So a recent example, for example, is what happened in New York City, when for a decade, people of color mostly were being stopped and frisked for no reason. And activists on the ground who saw this as an injustice changed that. It was found to be illegal. We have it now where the platform for Black Lives Matter is pushing to require protections for people of color when they encounter the police. I tell you all of this because we have all watched Law and Order, so we have a certain expectation of how it goes, and we know that law enforcement pushes as much as they possibly can, but we also see the limits to which rights can be pushed and how much those rights have to be respected. So getting back to Suave. So we never thought that Suave was going to get out. And again, because of individuals, a scientist, I think, is maybe how it started, who does brain research, really wanted to understand what it is about the adolescent brain. So now all of us know that there is brain research out there that shows that an adolescent brain actually is not fully developed until the ages of about 26. So all of you who are younger than 26, you are all adolescents. in terms of your brain. But this was not common science 25 years ago, right, when Suave was sentenced and thousands of juveniles were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Well, in 2012, the Supreme Court rescinded that and declared that it was inhuman to sentence a juvenile to life without the possibility of parole because of the science on adolescent brains. And in 2014, that Supreme Court decision was then open to be applied, like grandfathered in, to all of the juveniles serving life sentences in our country without the possibility of parole. Hence, Suave. So, Suave is getting out. In fact, today, here in Seattle, historic and important things always happen to me when I'm in Seattle. They do. I mean, they really do. I'm not going to start naming them. Some of them are a little sad, but some of them are kind of amazing. And so today, in my hotel room, Suave called me and he said, "I have my date. I'm getting out November 20th. At 6 o'clock in the morning, they're coming to get me. And I'm getting out." Which is like, I mean, you'll know more about Suave because we're doing an entire documentary about him. Because we've been recording our conversations for the last 3 years with Suave, not knowing if he was ever going to get out. And today was a little uncomfortable for me because Suave continued, well, actually he's never quite said it like this, and I'm gonna share it with you because it was really quite shocking, and I told him, I was like, "I just put on my makeup! You're gonna make me ruin it! Stop this!" Because what Suave said was, he said, "If you had not said those words to me, to be the voice for the voiceless," he says, "I think I would have been dead by now." And I said, "Come on, Suave." He said, "Maria, you gave me those words which opened my brain, and because of that, everything changed." And then he said, "And after you met me, you sent me a Christmas card every year. Every year I knew it was gonna come." He says, "I have them all collected." And so he said, "So you saved my life. I would be dead if it wasn't for you," he repeated again. And I just like, ugh. Because as I said to him, kind of yelling back at the finally, I said, "Suave, no, now you have to be quiet," I said, "because you know what, Suave? Okay, I'll take the credit for those words that I said, but I said, you were the one who walked up to me after I gave that commencement speech. You were the one that walked up to me and asked to speak with me. So you have to own your own power." And that's part of the theme of my speech today, is that if anything I want to leave you with is that it is in our own hands. It is in your hands. And the things that we do and maybe take for granted, because I never knew that me saying those words to Suave could potentially change his life. And all of us, that person, that scientist who uncovered that research around the adolescent brain that then teams of people took to the Supreme Court, those were not superhuman beings. They were just like you and me. So today, Suave did get emotional. It was an emotional call. I did get emotional. But in all of the years that I've known Suave, there's only been once when Suave has cried. And it was when he called into one of my classes at DePaul University, where I was teaching a class around the immigration and criminal industrial complex. And Suave was talking about what he's, because he's been there for 30 years, so he knows everything that has been happening in Greaterford Prison for 30 years. And he said, the people who are being treated the worst now are the immigrants, the ones who come and they don't speak English, the Mexicans, the Guatemaltecos, the Hondureños. all of them, they're treated the worst. He said, do you know, they force them to clean the entire block, which Suave says is the length of a football field. That's where all of the cells are. And they have to clean the entire block in order to get an extra plate of food. And he said, you know what they call them inside the prison? And this is when he started crying. He said, they call them the new black. I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, well, it used to be that black folks were the ones who had to do that to get a meal. Now, it's the immigrants, it's the Latinos. They are, in essence, the new lowest ones on the totem pole. And this caused Suave to cry. Which leads me to that phone call that Ms. Burton made on Saturday morning. Because when we were talking about this and she was saying how she how important she understood I had been for Suave because I had just been there, a presence. Again, I'm not a relationship. You can't call this person. It's not as if I'm gonna call Suave to start complaining about my life when he's sentenced to life in prison. So she said, you know, this experience that you have with Suave is really important. It's transformed his life. And then I explained to her this thing about Suave sharing this information about the new black. And she said, Ms. Burton said, oh yeah, we have a word for that. It's called crimigration. How many of you had heard that word before? Okay, so like less than a dozen of you. I think I had heard it before too, but it's like it really settled in on Saturday morning, crimigration. You know, this idea that essentially all immigrants are all potential criminals, or that we simply are criminals, that we don't belong here, that this thing about being an immigrant country is a thing of the past. I mean, we're living it with the attack that happened in New York City yesterday, and may the victims rest in peace. But you already saw it, right? Immediately, because this person was not born in the United States, immediately the whole conversation has now gone to restricting visas, to restricting immigrants, and the conversation again, I could not believe what I was hearing on CNN, on the plane right over here. We're just hearing mainstream media journalists who have no experience whatsoever covering immigrant communities or immigration law or immigration policies, all falling into step with President Trump saying, we've got to get rid of this lottery system. You know, he also used other choice words today. Animal, of course. An animal, again, referring to somebody who committed a horrible crime. But the animal part, I don't know. Is it because he wasn't born in this country? Did we hear him say those words about the Las Vegas shooter? You know, immigrants, the narrative is, we're scary, we're foreign, we're takers, we're abusers, we're criminals. So what happened yesterday with this alleged shooter is that because he's considered a foreign terrorist, he was not Mirandized. So when he was taken into custody, even though he was shot, he was not Mirandized. He was not told that anything he said could be used against him. He was not told that he could have access to a lawyer. And this bothered me deeply. And I want to share with you that I am a journalist who lived through September 11th. I covered that story. Not only did I cover that story for an entire year, every single day while I was at CNN, I developed PTSD. So after 9/11, I actually said and felt things that I now am shocked by. Because I lived through it, I know what that shock and fear looks like. As I was writing this, I said, am I gonna say this? And I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna say this because I'm honest with you. There was a moment when I remember somebody coming into my office, must have been less than 10 days after 9/11, and they were just like, can you believe that they're gonna start racially profiling? And I just said, racially profile everybody, me. So it's precisely because someone like me could think that way that I understand people's reaction, but that I'm so thankful to people who say, can we come back to the basis of our laws and due process, right? Because that is what our country is based on. And yes, there we can talk about immigration separately. It's complicated. Immigration laws specifically and the discrepancy around there, around those laws. But I don't know. I mean, are we afraid about that shooter getting a lawyer? The man who committed this crime yesterday? Do we not trust that a jury can actually judge him? Are we afraid of that? Of course, we lived through this after September 11th. Many of you are probably too young to remember, you know, because it was just about 16 years ago, but it was about 15 years ago that you may not remember when our government required that immigrants who were from predominantly Muslim countries had to register with the federal government, actually had to register. A year before 9/11, I was on the US-Mexico border witnessing people almost dying of thirst trying to get into this country. A year after 9/11, I'm on the US-Canadian border and I'm witnessing people running to get to the northern border to get out of our country in the freezing cold. Because these were people who were afraid. Maybe they had overstayed their visas. They were afraid that they were going to get deported. They were rushing to ask for asylum in Canada. So we have been here before. We have been here like the night that I was on the US-Mexico border that year before 9/11, and the Border Patrol was doing their, they're very nice, they do very good dog and pony shows for those of us in the media. They make sure that we get to see what it really looks like. So we were on a Border Patrol mission, and it was 9 o'clock at night. We had actually been on the mission for about 6 hours. We hadn't found any people yet, but suddenly they heard some crackle on the walkie-talkie, and we took off, and the Border Patrol guy took off, my cameraman, I was doing this for CNN, took off, my producer took off, and I, of course, was wearing high heels. They were very cute boots. So I was, you know, running a little bit slower than most, plus I'm a midget, so it takes me longer to get any place. I came upon the scene just a little bit after the men had been caught. It was about a dozen men from Mexico at that time who had been caught by the Border Patrol. And they were in shock. It was, you know, they were in the middle of the desert. There were lights on them. My cameraman was filming them. I ran up, you know, just basically saying, we're journalists. We're not the Border Patrol. We're journalists. Please trust us. Can we talk to you? And running out of breath with my high-heeled boots, I end up sitting, because they were all sitting, right in front of one of the men who had just been caught. And you know what he said to me? He took his water that he was crossing the border with to make it through the desert. He said, ¿Quiere mi agua, señorita? Do you want my water? Do you need my water? I see that you're out of breath. You know, those social skills that we bring with us immigrants, that you don't know about unless you listen to Latino USA, those social skills that are never talked about in this narrative, respeto, respect, human affection, humanity, gratitude, humility, servitude. In our schools, you have heard this statistic, that immigrant children come in with lesser reading skills because we don't have English language children's books in our homes, and that somehow we are less than when we walk into that kindergarten class. But what you don't hear about is all of the social skills that those children walk in with. Skills like being able to share with other kids, respect for the teacher, respect for the school, the actual building, a capacity to collaborate, a capacity to share, a capacity to be affectionate. Those are the social skills that the narrative denies us of. So why I do the work that I do is to try to impact this narrative. Why? Because actually, since September 11th, our newsrooms have become less diverse. I know you didn't know that either. Since September, our mainstream newsrooms have become less diverse than they were before 9/11, even though our demographics, as you know, are increasingly more and more diverse. So the story of change, the story actually of all of this demographic change, the story of immigrants, is problematic because we have newsrooms that are predominantly white, predominantly run by men. Some of who've been having some real problems recently. And we'll put that one over here. But I want to give you an example now. I want to move very specifically into what crimmigration looks like and the theme of this talk today, which is how due process is being tested, or the denial of due process is being tested on the backs of people whose only difference between you and them is the fact that they weren't born in this country. And that would include me, except for the fact that I became an American citizen in the late 1980s. And up until now, I'm not sure that they can rescind my citizenship, but yet. So when we started working on the Frontline documentary that was going to look at the whole kind of detention deportation monster, first of all, we were simply denied access to the detention camps. And I don't call them detention centers. That's a very tame name for what they are. They're detention camps. But we were simply denied access, which is one way of denying due process to journalists, right? You just deny access. Probably something else you didn't know. More money is spent on immigration, detention, deportation, and enforcement than all other federal law enforcement agencies combined. I'll repeat that. More money is spent on immigration, detention, deportation, and enforcement than all other federal law enforcement agencies combined. FBI, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, the Justice Department, police, all of that combined. More is being spent on immigration detention. The greatest profit being made now from private prison industries, from the private prison industry, is because of immigration detention. Right? They have got to keep the beds full in order to make a profit. So when you think about private prison industry, the only way they make money is to keep a body in the cell. The only way they make a profit off of immigrants in detention is to keep them in detention for as long as possible, as many people as possible. Now, these restrictive immigration laws actually started under a Democratic administration, signed into law in 1996 by President Bill Clinton. And they became intensified after 9/11 with George W. Bush. After 9/11, the narrative was, we've got to go and hunt them down, these foreigners. The narrative, again, is that they are terrorists, that they are lawbreakers, that they are an illegal people. So let's take a pause here for that conversation around the term illegal, right? There is no such thing as an illegal human being, right? Now, I didn't learn that from a radical Latino Latin American studies professor at Barnard College in New York City. Actually, I learned it from Elie Wiesel, who survived the Holocaust. And when I met Elie Wiesel, what he said to me, he said, the first thing the Nazis did was to declare the Jews to be an illegal people. That was how the Holocaust started. So, to declare an immigrant to be an illegal human being, it's the beginning of the dehumanization process. And by the way, that would be the equivalent of, like, all of you who have had a traffic violation when you've been driving, I know that, that would mean that you would all now be called illegal drivers, right? Because you committed a crime when you were driving, so you're now an illegal driver. If you're a parent that failed to pay your alimony, you would be forever an illegal father. Or if you're a taxpayer that forgot to pay your taxes, you would be forever an illegal taxpayer. No, you're a taxpayer who committed a crime. You're a driver who committed a crime. You're an immigrant who committed a crime. By the way, crossing the border without documentation is a misdemeanor. It has become criminalized only in the last decade, so that if you come back, now it is a felony. You're caught once and you come back to see your children, you are now a felon. But that's the reason why we don't use the term illegal in my newsroom. And that's the term why, that's the reason why I created my own newsroom, so I could make these kinds of decisions. We don't refer to human beings as illegal. That's right, because I'm the boss. I'm the boss. That was the whole idea. And I'm a pretty cool boss, you know, la pequeña jefa, because I'm a shorty. But in my newsroom, we don't use the term illegal to describe a human being. We also don't use the term minority. I'm not a minority. I don't see myself as a minority. I've never told my kids that they are minorities. So that is, and by the way, as we know, the demographic data shows who the minority will be in our country soon. So do we really want to be using that term, or do we really want to redefine that term? Thank you for those applause, right? All right, but getting back to the term illegal, right, and the issue of denying due process. So because they are an illegal people, they don't deserve equal treatment under the law, which is, in fact, untrue in our country. And I want to lay out the scenario for what it looks like when ICE is getting ready to do these encounters, what we witnessed when we were filming the Frontline documentary. So they gather the night before. What time is it? Yep. So right about now, you have immigration agents. Actually, they're asleep, and they're going to be waking up because their shift will be starting at about 3 in the morning. Somewhere around 4 or 5 in the morning, they'll be gathering in some undisclosed location, like the parking lot of a Burger King, where they will be making a plan of going in to detain immigrants from the long list that they have of immigrants who may have committed a crime, a petty crime, perhaps 20 years ago. So I'm going to actually give you this scenario of the case that we witnessed, which is another basic denial of due process, again, tested on the backs of people whose only difference between you and them is that they weren't born in this country. So one of the basics of law in this country is what? Double jeopardy. We understand that. You cannot be tried twice for the same crime. It's just part of who we are in this country, kind of like the First Amendment. Well, in the case of this Jamaican immigrant who we met, who had a green card. So this notion that the people who are in these immigration detention camps are just people without papers? No, they are filled with people with green cards. So I'm sorry to say, if you have a green card, it does not offer you much protection right now. I would urge you, if you have no interaction with the police, to begin your process of becoming an American citizen immediately. The green card provides you with no protection, I'm sorry to say, as someone who lived with one for 28 years. So this is a case of a Jamaican man who, when he came with a green card as a kid growing up in New York City, when he was around 18 or 19 years old, he's a punk. He's got an adolescent brain. He's selling some drugs on the street in the Bronx. He gets caught. He serves a year and a half for the petty crime of selling drugs. And since then, what would have happened in the mid-1980s, he had been clean, living with his green card in the Bronx, taking care of his mother and his wife. Well, on one of these nights, immigration agents came up with their list and decided they were going to go and get him from a housing project that he lived in the Bronx, and they took him. Even though he had already been tried and convicted and served for that crime, because he had a green card, he was taken for having committed that crime. He was put into a detention camp on the border, a place called Willacy, in Raymondville, Texas. And there, this man who actually had suffered and been diagnosed as bipolar had no mental health support at all. He was brutalized. He witnessed fights. He witnessed, they're not corrections officers, but the people, the guards inside the immigration camp, beating people, hearing about rapes. He was deeply depressed, and so what did they do? Well, they over-medicated him, put him to sleep for 36 hours. So bad that he fell off of his bunk, which was about at this level, literally just rolled off, did not even know because he was so heavily drugged, that he broke his part of this bone here and actually broke a testicle. And it was because of all of this and his complaints and his threats to bring this to light that he was released and we interviewed him. And he had already been tried and served for the crime that he had committed, a way in which due process is denied, basic due process is denied. Okay, so back to the night before, what they're getting ready to do tonight here in Seattle and in cities and towns all across the United States tonight, on nights like tonight, they will be wearing uniforms that misidentify who they are. Basic issue of due process, know which law enforcement agency you're dealing with. In fact, it is illegal to impersonate law enforcement officers. But what are they wearing? They are wearing hats that say police in big letters. They're wearing jackets that say police in big letters and police in big letters, and in smaller letters it says ICE. They are not police. It is illegal for them to be identifying themselves as police. They do not arrest people. In fact, they detain people because these are not criminals. These are immigrants who have a civil charge, and yet they are treated as if they're criminals. So misidentifying themselves as police, it's kind of as if, like, you know, you get a knock on your door and you find somebody there that has a police uniform and you're like, my God, it's the police, I have to let them in. And then all of a sudden they're like, haha, we're not the police, we're actually the IRS and you didn't pay your taxes, we're taking you. And you'd be just like, what just happened? Or they'd come to your door with outfits saying that they're police and they'd come in and they'd say, haha, we're not police, we're actually social service and we're taking your kids away because of et cetera, et cetera. It's like, that's not the way it's supposed to go in our country. That is the way it goes in our country, day after day after day. And because of the shame of what we are living through in this country, it's not as if you're having people come to this campus and say, let me tell you what happened to my mom last night. She was detained by ICE. So there is so much shame that we're not even talking about this. So what do? They arrive at your home, they meet in this nondescript parking lot someplace. They're all, you know, like in riot gear with police everywhere. They arrive at your door at 6 a.m. and they're banging on your door like that. So you're just like startled, you don't know what's going on. You wake up, you're in your pajamas, and they basically say to you, hey, and all you can see is the police, right? And they just say, hey, we, you know, can we come in? We'd rather not talk about this on your front doorstep and make a scene for your neighbors to see. And of course, you're like, well, okay, come on in. And the second that they come in with no warrant, then they can ask anyone in that house for their papers. No Miranda, no explanation of what is going to happen, of what is happening at that moment. So I don't know, what do you think about the fact that right now there are innocent people being held by our government, who don't know where they are, who don't know why they've been held, why they're being held, how long they're going to be held, how to get out, and the fact that they don't have an access to a lawyer. What do you think about that? That on a daily basis we have people being held in our country who I have spoken to and asked them, do you know why you're here and when you might get out? And they say, no, No, they won't let me go. I want to go home. Okay, I came without papers, but I want to go home. They won't even release me to go home. How do you feel about the fact that that is happening in your country on a daily, nightly basis? How do you feel about the fact that it is common sense now, knowledge among immigrants, that when they are detained by the Border Patrol and put into those immigration camps, that the first place that they're put into is a place commonly known as La Hielera, which means the icebox? That this is common, that people whose only crime is that they are crossing without papers, and the first place that they are put when they are detained is into a place that is known as the icebox because it is so cold there. And you're sweating because you've just been in the desert and you have nothing except for a t-shirt. And they put you into La Hielera. And everybody who has come into this country and been held in one of these places knows about La Hielera. And it's been happening for years and years and years. How do you prove that that's torture? There's no marks on you. That is happening on a daily, nightly basis in our country. How do you feel about the fact that there are no legally binding standards for how they are held, the conditions under which they are held, how much they are fed, how much sunlight they are given, how much recreation, if they have access to books, to a movie, to a bathroom, to a pad when you're a woman having a period? There are no legally binding standards for immigrants who are held in our immigration detention camps. There are recommendations. But if you're a private prison company, you'll take those recommendations and you're going to be looking at one thing only, which is your bottom line. So actually, compared to the Bureau of Prisons, the official Bureau of Prisons for criminals, criminals get much better treatment in the Bureau of Prisons. You know exactly what you are legally entitled to in terms of food portions, your legal rights. You don't have that if you're an immigrant.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 CM. Maria Hinojosa gave this talk, Testing the Limits of Due Process Denial, Latinos and Immigrants as the Canaries in the Mine, at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on November 1st, 2017. You can hear the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.